Okay, so I guess everybody submitted their domains, right? Okay. So is there, does anybody have something to say about this exercise? When we could spend a few minutes. I mean, I'll actually go through what you guys did, but I mean, it's more of a question of seeing whether interesting things can be written as PDDL and whether you found it easier to write operator descriptions, whether it was harder, whether you had to go back and forth. Yeah?
So was the point of this more to find out what are the difficulties when modeling certain problems to fit into PDDL?
Everything together, I guess, basically. Because I didn't give you a problem, you picked up your own problem. I think everything together, because you haven't done either of them, right? You didn't do evaluation of planners, you also didn't do, and actually I guess in a way if you want to just evaluate performance of the planners, you would take existing benchmarks, and there are several existing benchmarks, but this is partly also trying to write your own and then running some planner and seeing whether it's hard or not. Okay. Probably I wouldn't be surprised if most of the domains that you wrote were quite easy for the planners. Has anybody been able to write? Yes.
The problem that I saw that the manual problem is usually
written
in the shortest
path. Depends on whether you're using. So which planner are you using?
FF.
FF. So FF is not, basically FF is using relaxed plan heuristic, right? So plus it also does what's called enforced hill climbing. Both of which together mean that it's not a star search with admissible heuristic. So it's not guaranteed to find optimal plans. Okay, so again, that's the sort of thing that you want to, you know, it does, it's not at all surprising that it doesn't find optimal plans. The question, of course, is how badly inoptimal are the plans, and the degree of inoptimality seems to differ from domain to domain. So FF did reasonably do well in terms of solving problems fast, but not, it never made a claim for optimality. Okay. Yes.
Also noting that large number, so whatever be your domain, if you give it, if you vary your problem file, so if you have a large number of objects, then because they ground, a lot of planners lose out in that. So there's clearly, you can see a clear speed difference in planners. So for example, on my domain, if you give it a problem file with a lot of objects, then FF and SG plan were in kind of in one category. They did solve it, but they took some time. SAPA was in a whole other category. SAPA would just go off into its own. It wouldn't return anything. Even if you increase the heap size, it would just keep working in the background and never return the plan for that. So you can actually see that it stratifies into.
Yeah, so actually, I mean, this issue of having irrelevant initial state literals, that's one way you can make planners do badly. Especially the ones that ground, and especially those that start from the initial state. But there are ways you can avoid that problem. But I guess the best way presumably would have been to do lifted representation, but nobody uses it. That's part of the thing that we talked about, where, and also goal-directed reasoning. Those are the two things. So lifted representation in particular actually requires goal-directed reasoning anyway, because you can only do ground actions when you go forward pretty much. But that's a good point. Any other comments? Yes. That's very interesting. I don't quite know what that error is. So one thing that FF does do is, so you know, for those of you who remember normal A star search, essentially is looking at, you know, if you have you have a fringe of search nodes that still need to be expanded, right? And these guys are all sitting on the open list. And, you know, normal A star search basically evaluates them in their F values, which is G plus H. Okay? G being the cost to come to that node, and H is the cost you think you're going to incur to go from there to the goal node. And then you sort the open list from high to low, I mean low to high values, and pick the lowest F value and expand it. That's what A star search does. If you are doing that, and if your H is such that it is a lower bound on the true cost, that is, it never overestimates the true cost to goal, then you are guaranteed that A star search, when it picks a node for expansion and finds it's a goal node, it's guaranteed to be optimal. Okay. And so, for example, if H equal to 0, it will be guaranteed to be a lower bound. That's why breadth first search is guaranteed to give you, I mean uniform cost search is guaranteed to give you optimal solutions. Okay. Now, the problem, of course, is in the case of FF, first of all, H is not admissible, because H is relaxed plan heuristic. And we talked about the fact that relaxed plan heuristic will not be admissible. What can you do to make relaxed plan heuristic admissible? Optimal relaxed plan. If you found the optimal relaxed plan, it would be admissible. Okay. The reason it's not admissible is that you find the greedy relaxed plan. But finding the optimal relaxed plan is essentially NP complete. Okay, so you can make the heuristic admissible, but it's costly. So that's why FF doesn't do it. Okay, that's one reason. The other thing is, so just for that itself, FF is going to give you an inoptimal solution. Just for that itself, FF is going to give you an inoptimal solution. Okay, but as long as you're sunk anyway, you know, in the sense you can no longer give any guarantees about optimality, you may as well do other things also which will cause inoptimality, because you're anyway getting inoptimality because of this. Okay. One thing that all of you remember, of course, from the search lectures, there is no such thing as sometimes optimal, sometimes not optimal. Either you guarantee optimality or you don't guarantee optimality. Okay, because once the solution comes out, checking whether it is not optimal after the fact is infeasible. Okay, checking whether a solution is correct is easy, because correctness is a local property of that specific solution. Optimality, on the other hand, is a global property of all the solutions together. This is optimal because there's nobody else better than this solution. And so you can't actually, if I give you a solution, you can't just look at it and say, yes, it's optimal, no, it's not optimal. Okay, you may sometimes say, yeah, it must be definitely inoptimal because it's going to the same state 5 times. But you can never be able to prove optimality. You may be able to disprove optimality in some cases, but never be able to prove optimality unless the search algorithm is designed such that by design, when it stops, it's going to be optimal. Okay, and that would happen only if you do G plus H and H is actually equal to, H is an admissible heuristic. Okay. Now, there are several things. Once, you know, you take the relaxed plan, so FF is, you know, inadmissible because H is relaxed plan heuristic. Secondly, if I remember correctly, and those of you, I believe many planners, and I probably think is FF too, would actually not put F equal to G plus H, they normally give higher value to H, higher weight to H. Okay. This is one way you can make the search be more directed more by the heuristic. Okay. So normally you could say F equal to G plus 2H. Okay. The moment you give higher weight to the heuristic, then you're again dead. Even if heuristic was admissible to begin with, if you give it higher weightage than the G value, you no longer are probably optimal. But then any one of them is good enough to, you know, invalidate optimality. So it does all of this. And then much more importantly, actually, the other thing that FF does is during the search, it does this thing called enforced hill climbing. And what enforced hill climbing is that, I hope I remember it correctly, but rather than go back to the open list every time, once it picks a node to expand, it tries to continue under that node many more levels as long as the F value is improving. Okay, now that's basically that saying, now that I have decided to go this direction, I will try to go further in this direction rather than look at the entire search fringe. It makes for going, in fact, one of the biggest problems about optimal searchers in general is that after having gotten the optimal node, the solution node, onto the open list, it will take ages before they actually pick it for expansion. Because they will pick it for expansion only when they have proved to themselves that no other partial solution can potentially ever overtake the current full solution. Right? That's what it's doing. That's how it makes sure. And so obviously, but if you don't actually care about optimality, anyway you're not able to guarantee optimality because you're using relaxed plan heuristic on one hand, then you may as well actually make it more directed. Okay? And so in fact, hill climbing, if you just did, for example, one other thing you could have done is to do what's called greedy best first search, where you don't basically, all you do is you use H to expand the nodes, ignore G. Okay, F is actually FF is doing is a kind of a mixture where it in fact is using F equal to G plus H, but then it tends to stick to the current promising direction unless it's no longer promising, and then it goes back. Promising means, hill climbing, you try to go in a direction if in fact the merit keeps increasing. Okay, from the point of view of FF, you know, what you really want is the F value is improving. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you're saying that you may have, for example, like 5 or 6 variables, only one of them can be true.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's actually a very interesting point. So there are PDDL, normal PDDL requires that all the variables are Boolean. What you really need is a multi-valued variable. Okay? And the current, I mean, in fact, this is a very well-known weakness of the existing PDDL standard, but as of like the next competition, the next competition is going to be held in like what, April, May time frame, and so they already came up with extensions to PDDL language where you can declare a variable to be multi-valued. Currently already what is happening is people write the domains this way using Boolean descriptions, but then underneath it all actually planners wind up noticing, so in fact this notion of multi-valuedness, I described this, you know, if you go back the same time when I described lifting, I also talked about multi-valued variables. Okay, and one of the interesting things about multi-valued variables is sometimes you actually want to declare certain things to be multi-valued, and that way you don't have to make the kind of mistakes that you just said exactly. Okay, another time, even if you didn't declare it, the planners actually would like to know that certain things are multi-valued, because it turns out that imagine what happens if in fact, even if you wrote everything correctly in terms of domain specification, okay, suppose it turns out that there are n variables, v1, etc., vn, such that only one of them is actually ever going to be true. And if you define them as Boolean variables, what happens? What happens is that you will wind up essentially having lots and lots of mutual exclusions. If V1 and V2 cannot be ever true together, V2 and V3 cannot be true together, V1 and V3 cannot be true together. So you wind up, instead of just saying all of these are really one variable V which has n possible values, right? You would wind up saying V1 to Vn which have all Boolean, and then you will put n square mutual exclusions. Okay, now these mutual exclusions, you don't say it. Essentially, your domain dynamics essentially ensure that V1 cannot have more than one value at the same time. So if you had defined the V as a multi-valued variable, it's quite clear that a single fluent can only have one value. But if you modeled, if you either by mistake or because the language forced you to model this way, then it's not at all obvious whether V1 and V2, that in fact only one of V1 to Vn can actually be true at any given time. The way it becomes clear is that action descriptions essentially make it clear. And so they are indirectly made clear in the planning. So planners figure this out essentially. Okay. However, one very interesting point, I mean, as long as we are at the multi-valued variables, one interesting point that comes up is the following thing. Suppose you know that n-valued variable really is, it's a multi-valued variable with n possible values. You are forced to write it as n different variables, n different Boolean variables. Okay. Then you use relaxed plan heuristic. What does relaxed plan heuristic do? It ignores all the negative interactions. Do you understand what I'm saying? It ignores all the negative interactions. It's bad enough that there were real negative interactions that you're ignoring, but these fake negative interactions, which were there not because of the domain, but because you couldn't write what you had in mind correctly, would also be ignored. So the relaxed plan length in those cases is going to be much more misleading. Much more misleading. So remember, I was talking to you about how when do you need to take negative interactions into account? Okay, it's better not to have to take negative interactions into account because that increases the heuristic cost. However, in many domains where essentially there are variables that are multi-valued and you didn't either realize it or you were forced to write them as Boolean variables, in those domains, relaxed plan heuristic winds up misleading you quite badly. One way you can avoid that is, of course, to say, I would use negative interactions also in the heuristic construction. So use mutual exclusion propagation. But normally, that's too costly. So what do you do? What you can do is the following thing. You were forced to write this. Now, you go from this domain description and write a little preprocessor which looks at the domain description. Okay, so think about the funny thing that's going on. You want to give me multi-valued variables. Me, the planner, want to take multi-valued variables. There is this PDDL sitting in the middle which is forcing us to deal with Boolean variables because they didn't support it. So what do? I essentially take the Boolean description, pre-process it, to detect if there were multi-valued variables within this description.
So keep the same initial phase and change
the goal? No, just a second. So there are techniques in which you can use, and I'll tell you in a minute how to get those techniques, that basically can make you realize that given the domain, certain variables really should be seen as, you know, like these n variables together should be seen as an n-valued Boolean multi-valued variable. Now, if you do that, suppose you did that, I mean, suppose I have a way of figuring that out, then the beautiful advantage is now you have some variables which are multi-valued, some which are, you know, of course, Boolean is just a special case of multi-valued. But now if you use relaxed plan heuristic on top of that, it's going to be much less misleading than before. Because in the pre-processing stage, by figuring out that some of the Boolean variables are really should be seen as a single multi-valued variable, you have done some negative interaction analysis. Okay, and this idea actually has been used, more or less this idea has been used in something called SAS Downward, which is a planner that's built on top of FF, which is in fact faster than FF. What SAS Downward does is it takes the same exact PDDL descriptions and does a very quick pre-processing stage to try and detect any multi-valued variables masquerading as sets of Boolean variables. Once it detects them, then it just makes a new variable name. As far as the planner is concerned, it uses this new translated name. Now, and then it uses relaxed plan heuristic, essentially. But then you have, in doing the pre-processing, you did the negative interaction analysis. And so the relaxed plan heuristic then becomes much more effective. Okay, and fast downward beats FF pass downward beats FF. Okay, and we will at some point of time probably talk about pass downward, although I didn't mention it, you know, until now. The part of the problem is I want to move from classical to other different kinds of learning techniques, but in the literature, there's still people working on better heuristics for classical planning. And in a way, we need to think about them too. So my current best idea is that as we go towards the end of the semester, then we will start having more on heuristics, one lecture, more on knowledge-based planning, one lecture, and so on. So to add extra stuff more and over and above what we have done. Now, of course, it turns out, you know, in as much as all this discussion makes you wonder, how exactly do you pre-process? How exactly do you figure out that the variables, certain set of variables, are essentially together, essentially making one single multi-valued variable? It's not that hard. It turns out that if you have variables v1, v2, etc., vn, and then you have a bunch of actions, you know, a1, etc., up to am, then you can start making links between variables. If, for example, an action a1 takes v1 and changes v2, then v1 and v2 are connected causally. Okay, and so there is this idea called causal graph, which, you know, when we look at pass downward, we will talk about it more formally. All that does is essentially it's looking at actions syntactically, and if, you know, v1 is appearing in the preconditions and v2 is appearing in the effects of an action, then in some sense they're connected. Okay, it's slightly more involved than that, but that's more or less the main idea. So if you put these edges on the variables now, and then if you look for cliques, you know, essentially that winds up being related to the notion of multi-valued variables sitting in the planning graph, sitting in the graph. Okay, there is a better way of thinking of these whole things once you get to multi-valued variables. We will do that, but it's a nice idea to keep in mind that, in essence, when the domain language forced you to write about a multi-valued variable as a Boolean variable, you can still make up for the failure. Now, as I said, as of this coming competition, PDL language itself is extended such that you can directly define multi-valued variables. But even if you allow people to define multi-valued variables, they may still decide to write Boolean variables. Sometimes the natural way you think about a domain may not be the most efficient way of thinking about that domain for the planner. So this kind of pre-processing is still needed. Okay. But at least it won't be forced, I mean, it won't be because people were forced to write it in the suboptimal way. Other questions? Okay, I will give you the link to the paper that talks about pass downward, which is actually quite easy to understand based on, you know, all the things that you already know, but we would more than likely we will discuss it, that technique, at some point of time during the semester. Okay. Any other things about domain? Okay. So what I plan to do today is I was actually going to go into oversubscription planning, but I thought since we are talking so much about domain knowledge, and we, you know, there was this so basically, let's see, I'm sorry. You know, we had this picture, right? This is what got us into domain knowledge on top of normal domain models, okay? And then, so the question is, you are somehow providing extra domain knowledge to a customizable planner so that it will be speeded up. That was the idea. And until in the last two classes, we talked about how such a knowledge could be provided by domain writer, essentially, as HTN schemas, or as TL plan rules, or as SAT encoding rules, etc., etc. Okay. One issue, of course, one idea is to say, why not just learn it automatically? Okay, if people don't give it to you, could you learn it? And which types of these things can you learn? Okay, it turns out that not everything that we actually talked about can be learned. In fact, it's still not possible, I mean, there are still no good methods to learn HTN schemas are to learn TL plan rules, which should not be surprising. If you remember the TL plan rule I showed you for the blocks world, learning that isn't all that easy. Okay, it's still open. However, there are lots and lots of things that you can learn. And one advantage, once you start thinking about learning the knowledge and using it, a big advantage is you are no longer imposing your will on a domain writer. Okay, remember much of the discussion in the last two classes was, yeah, this kind of knowledge would make my life easy, but domain writers might mind it, you know, might be put in a spot trying to give it in this inflexible way. Okay, if I'm learning it and I'm using it, why do you care? Do you understand what I'm saying? So I could be thinking of things, I mean, as long as the planner is learning, I mean, as a planner, learner, agent together is learning whatever it wants and uses it to improve its performance, you don't care. Okay? And one of the interesting things, of course, is you could now learn the kinds of control knowledge that you would never, ever expect a domain writer to provide to you. What's basically called control rules, search control rules, for example, which say to the planner that when you have the following partial plans on the queue, and when you are about to work on the following open condition flaw, and if the following unsafe link flaws exist, then use the following establisher for this open condition flaw. Okay, nobody, no domain writer will ever give this kind of a knowledge, because domain writer's life is hard enough to think about the domain. To ask for this kind of knowledge, they need to think about the domain as well as how you do the planning to give this knowledge. You understand what I'm saying? Okay. Now, this is not too surprising, even though this should be obvious that no, we should never ask domain writers to give this kind of a knowledge. People went ahead and asked for this anyway. In fact, a classic case is there is this one planner called HSTS, which was used by NASA in a pretty highly publicized experiment, RAX experiment, remote agent experiment, where they were able to, yeah, he was just doing work, I think, where they were able to control, essentially this was like, they were able to control rovers on Mars or something, I forget exact details, but it was like a pretty big deal. It was a, you know, high-flying experiment. Now there, their planner is slow as a turtle. Okay, it's a very expressive planner. It's more, I mean, and it does more or less partial order planning, and it was very slow. And so they needed control knowledge. And the control knowledge they wanted was of the type that would be most beneficial to the planner, which is exactly of this type. When I have the following things on my queue, and I have already worked on this, and the following thing, unsafe links are still there, pick this particular kind of establishment. Obviously it's silly, right? Because you would not have domain writers who know your planner. But don't laugh too much, because when you write prologue programs, put cuts in the prologue program, that's exactly what you're doing. Okay? In a prologue program, what does prologue say? Just give me the domain knowledge and declaratively I will do the search. And then if you just do it, then essentially it's slow as a dog. I mean, slow as a turtle, whatever is the slowest thing, right? And then so you need to give it a little push. To give it a little push, you start putting cuts. Now to put the cuts, you not only need to know about your problem that you're writing about, but you need to know about how prologue works. Okay, this is exactly the kind of thing we are saying is wrong, and that's why, you know, prologue, there is this, you know, divided opinion as to whether or not prologue really allows declarative problem solving. Okay. However, if this stuff is being done automatically, if I learned my rules automatically myself, it's not none of your business why, you know, I'm learning these rules as against HTN schema. Why do you care? Okay, so the point I'm trying to make is once you start thinking in terms of automated learning of control knowledge, you could do other kinds of control knowledge, even if it looks quite infeasible to get from any domain writer. Okay, and in fact, it's been tried, and we will look at some of that. Okay. So now when you're thinking, I mean, as far as we came to learning with planning, we came here more or less today from this point to improve speed of the underlying planner, because that's more or less what we did in the HTN schemas, in the TL plan rules, etc. Okay, but there is a completely orthogonal motivation for learning, which we will, you know, mention, but we won't talk much about in today's class. We'll come back to it later on during the semester. Okay. So here it's improved speed. So the assumption is you have the domain model. You just want search control. You want to learn search control somehow or other. Okay. Speed up the planner. Here you want to just reduce the domain modeling effort, which some of you hopefully could agree is a useful thing. You know, if you thought of a problem and you started writing domain models, you know, if some of you actually first time you wrote, you realize that you may have missed some preconditions or you wrote wrong effects, etc., then you will realize that domain modeling is a fault, you know, is an error prone activity. And in fact, the planner should learn the domain models as it tries to start with incomplete models, makes plans, executes them, fails, and tries to learn what exactly went wrong. Okay, as long as you're thinking in terms of learning, you could learn to improve the domain model, or you can also learn to improve the speed. Okay, we will mostly look at this today, and this one will come back later. Okay, one of the interesting things is a huge amount of work on learning techniques for planning was originally focused on improving speed. Why? Because they were very slow, and so you needed all the help you can get to speed them up. Okay, and over a period of time, because of the heuristics, the domain independent heuristics, etc., planners are reasonably fast. So you didn't quite need learning techniques just to improve speed. So the work on learning techniques to improve speed sort of reduced. There's much fewer papers between, let's say, 95 and 2002-2003 on learning techniques for planning. And again, it's coming back now because we actually are finding that, for example, things like you could still learn TL plan rules, and TL plan does seem to do much faster than any heuristic planner. So, you know, you could try to learn the kind of rules that Bacchus is writing himself. Okay, and that's something that you could try to do. And we'll actually find one, the topic, the paper that I asked you guys to read is, I like it a lot. In fact, you know, Fung Wook should have been here today, he's not here. But basically what he did was he realized, look, see, if everything that you're doing is a heuristic-based planning, and if the heuristic is right, the planner does well. If the heuristic is wrong, the planner does, you know, inefficient search. So why not improve the heuristic? Why not learn to improve the heuristic? And that's exactly the paper you read. So basically what he was doing, if you remember, and we'll get back to it again towards the end of the class, is he was learning deltas for the relaxed plan heuristic. So relaxed plan heuristic says for a given state and a goal, this is the number. This is the how costly it is to get, how many actions are needed to go to the goal state. Now after the problem solving is over, he knows actually how long it took to go to the goal state. So take the difference between what was predicted and what was achieved, and that's the delta. And he tries to learn to predict that delta based on the features of the state. It's a learning problem. Okay? It's a very different way of looking at learning. Now, if you imagine asking a domain writer, you know, I have this relaxed plan heuristic, why don't you write a few rules telling me what is the delta for my relaxed plan? They'll throw you out of the room. But if I learn it, you shouldn't bother me. When I learn it, I use it, you shouldn't bother. You shouldn't worry, you know, worry about how I did it, why I did it. Okay? So there are things that you can do when you're learning, which is, as far as your end goal is to improve speed, there's nothing wrong with it. Right? That's the idea. Okay. This we already saw. So in terms of the customization of the planners, what we looked at was this. Until last two classes, domain writers, humans actually doing customization. And when the humans do customization, you know, they tend to do things like HTN schemas or TL plan rules or SAT plan rules. These are the examples that we have looked at. And then you can do automated learning. When you learn automatically, you can learn search control rules, which basically are of the form, when you have the following partial plan with the following flaws in it, and if you pick this flaw to work on, or if you did pick this flaw to work on, use this establishment. That's the kind of rules you can learn. Okay? And in fact, UCPOP EBL did that. UCPOP is a partial order planner, and you add on top a learning technique which essentially learns the search control rules for this partial order planner. And prior to that, Prodigy EBL did essentially the same thing to Prodigy. Prodigy is a later day STRIPS. It's a mean sense analysis planner. And, you know, again, what would be the import, if you remember sort of vaguely what we talked about mean sense analysis planning, STRIPS planning previously, remember when you put a bunch of sub-goals on the stack, you need to decide which order to put them in. If the order you put them in doesn't work, you have to reverse, change the ordering. If there are n sub-goals, you have to try all n factorial ordering. What if you learned the right ordering? That's good. And similarly, when you pick a sub-goal, you have to try putting an action for it. There are multiple actions. And the action that you pick doesn't work, you have to backtrack and change the action. What if you learned which action to pick? Or what if instead you learned which action not to pick? It's equivalent, right? Telling you what to pick is similar to telling you what not to pick. If I tell you what not to pick, then you'll stop picking that, and whatever else is remaining, you pick those. Okay? That's the kind of rules that UCPOP EBL and Prodigy EBL learned. And both of them use what's called an explanation-based learning technique. We'll talk a little bit about it, hopefully, today. But it's a kind of technique which makes a lot of sense when you have complete domain theories, which you do have. I mean, any domain theory, in fact, which you do have, so that you can explain why the plan is correct, or you can explain why the plan is incorrect. Now, it turns out, even if you can explain partially why the plan is correct, or partially why the plan is incorrect, that, too, is explanation-based analysis. And that can help in terms of search, in learning. The kind of learning that you guys mostly know about is classification learning, where you have some bunch of positive examples, some bunch of negative examples for a concept. Okay, and then you're trying to learn how to predict, given a new example, whether a label is going to be positive or negative. In trying to predict this, you normally assume that the examples are described in terms of some set of features. And then you try to learn to fit this in a function based on these features to the label. If I give you too many features, part of the problem, of course, is you will wind up deciding which features are relevant, which features are irrelevant. And you can get all sorts of overfitting problems. You can also get all sorts of bad learning issues. You know, if you remember, for example, if I were to have my favorite example, which is a coin toss experiment. Okay, if the coin comes heads, that's a positive, comes tails, it's negative. Okay, and then I describe my examples in the following way. Today is Tuesday, I'm wearing my blue shirt, my red shoes, and I have a green hat, and there are 7 people in the room, and the door is closed, and I toss the coin, it came heads. And then tomorrow, the whole shebang again with different shirt, different number of people, I toss the coin, it came tails. And I give you a whole bunch of examples like this. Now, if I ask you to predict, given a new example, okay, so given it is November, 18th, and the door is closed, and there are 4 people in the room, and you are given a coin, toss the coin, and, I mean, what do you think it'll say? It'll say heads or tails. Most learners, believe it or not, try to come up with a complex formula involving essentially the door being closed, the number of people in the room, etc., because they have no clue as to how these features are causally connected to the actual outcome of the experiment. And this is easy to laugh at the learner, but we did this all our lives. You know, in civilization, we did this. We used to think, you know, certain things cause certain things. And so, like, for example, you know, 5 times you had, some sort of an accident, and 3 of those times a black cat came in front of you, so you come up with this great, you know, predictor that you see a black cat, you'll get into trouble. And even now, we are very worried, apparently, about Friday the 13th. Okay. Now, you know, clearly, we make these things up. The point is, until you know the causation, everything you learn could be laughable. Once you learn it, once you know that, you know, the coin toss has nothing to do with the door, you get to laugh at your learner. But an advanced civilization looks at us and laughs at us, looking at the way we are trying to, you know, cure diseases, not knowing, you know, what causes what. Okay, so the point, of course, is in these kinds of scenarios, if you have a way of predicting which features are really relevant in causing the label, even if you only have a partial theory of which features are relevant in causing the label, then you can just focus on those features. Okay, even if you don't have a complete explanation. So for example, you know, my favorite example is that, you know, my car may be working some days, not working, starting some days, not starting some days. Okay, I'm trying to figure out what might be the reason my car is starting versus not starting. But I have no real clue about how cars work. But even I, as dumb as I am, know that the color of the car has nothing to do with whether it starts or not. So I first remove the color from my feature space. Okay, and the cushiness of the chair has nothing to do with whether or not the car is starting. So I remove the things that are completely irrelevant, and then the rest of them are potentially relevant, and then I try to, you know, look at the examples and fit a theory. And that's exactly what explanation-based learning can do for you when you're even in the context of classification. Yes, sir. Yes, yes, the point is, okay, so the basically exactly the same thing happens even in the case of planner. So suppose I have a state with a bunch of literals, and when I went from this state, I failed. That means I didn't reach the goal. So what part of this state features, you know, how to describe this state in terms of features. One reasonable thing to do is say all the facts that are true in the state and all the facts that are true in the false in the state. That's the description. But that could be pretty large. Because that's an actually, in fact, the moment you ask that question, you know, so let me just say, why do you think that people should give you only the relevant facts for explaining something that happens to you in your life? It's not at all anybody's, you know, it's like if you want to make the learner's job easy, you will remove all the irrelevant factors and put the relevant factors. But part of learning is figuring out what is relevant. Okay, I mean the same thing for planning too. Like, why don't I say, don't give me anything that's not going to be relevant for my goals. I mean, in fact, even my better example is in classes, right? I mean, you know, you want to do well in the final in many classes, and most students tell me, don't tell me anything that's not going to be on the final. I am going to tell you everything that's not going to be on the final, and you have to figure out. That's how life is. That's the way, figuring out relevance is up to you, not up to me, because it could be relevant for a different final.
The problem that's being is that you're first saying this is relevant to the planner, and you're adding that as a premise. Then you're telling it with your own knowledge that it's not relevant. Then you're following.
No, I did not add anything. I did not add anything. So the point is, even in the car scenario, there should be some way of describing it, okay? And I take a snapshot of my car. There are bunches of things I will say. If I just show you the snapshot of the car, you will say, yeah, the car is red, it has cushy chairs, it's Honda, it is this, it's that. All of those are features. You don't quite know what I am trying to learn from it. Okay? So this is actually a serious problem. It's not something I made up. In fact, there is an entire area in machine learning called feature selection. And Huan Lu, Professor Huan Lu, his whole life is feature selection. That's all he does. Okay, and so you could ask, why do you even have a job? And you should actually after this and then see what he says. But the point is, he does have a job because nobody tells you what are the relevant features. And you can easily overfit. And this happens, for example, in spam mails. You know, how does it, the spam mail, it would be so easy if the mails came with a flag on them saying, I'm kind of spam. Then you know that it is spam. You know, but they don't come. You know, in fact, in the spam case, it's actually, they are very interested in making sure that you won't be able to classify them as spam. So they'll keep changing the speech features. So you have everything in the mail. That's all you have. All the text in the mail is part of the feature space. And you still need to figure out what is relevant, what's not relevant. And the point I'm trying to make is even if you have partial theories of causation, even if you don't have complete theories of causation, that can be used as a way of selecting features. Okay, so that's how you can think of EBL. If you only knew classification learning, think of EBL as a knowledge-based feature selection strategy. If you have partial background knowledge, then you can use that to select features. Okay, if you have complete background knowledge, if you have complete background knowledge, then that becomes a special case where the explanation itself completely explains why the car didn't work. And so you don't even need induction step. So classification learning is induction, right? You don't even need an induction step if you have the complete understanding of why cars work and why they don't work. Then you know exactly why it didn't work in this particular case. But if you have partial, then you can use that as a feature selection strategy and build an induction on top of it, which would be more effective. Okay? And in the case of normal learning that you may have come across before you thought about learning in the context of planning, for example, many of you probably these days heard about data mining and you know all this stuff. Many of these scenarios, domain knowledge is more or less non-existent. Okay, or it's like you are not expected to think that there is any background knowledge. And so you assume, you know, whatever I can do in terms of fitting these features, maybe I'll do a pre-processing step to remove some of the features and then try to do my learning. But there is no point of talking about domain knowledge. But if you're learning in the context of planning, you already have a domain knowledge which can explain to you why the plan is correct, why it is incorrect. And I believe that, you know, there are enough scenarios in between where you have partial knowledge of why things work, like my car example. And so even as a machine learning scenario, it's worth understanding that sometimes feature selection can be done by background knowledge. Okay? If you haven't heard about this, this is news to you. If you have thought about it before, it's not. And then, so the, you can do the search control rules, you can do case-based planning, where essentially you remember plans that you formed previously for different problems, and then you try to reuse them so that you can cut down the search. Okay? And then, as I said, learning and adjusting heuristics. This is something that's quite new, but you know that's one way you can do it. Okay? Domain pre-processing, there's a whole bunch of domain pre-processing techniques which essentially try to say, you know, many of these things are directly working on the search. Here, you start with a domain and change the domain upfront. And then the planner uses the simplified domain. Okay? These can also be thought of as essentially, you know, learning techniques, but we won't talk about most of these in this today's class. Okay. In particular, for example, there are a bunch of things like learning higher order mutual exclusion relations, even without doing planning graph. In fact, you could say, you know, if I did find a higher order mutual exclusion relation that will hold in a particular domain, I can use that to improve search. Okay. So things of that kind fall under that category. Notice that there is a different set of things that I'm looking here than the ones here. Of course, plus everything here can also be learned. It's just that it hasn't. There are not yet any techniques that are good in learning HTN and TL plan rules. Okay, so that you can do, for example. Okay. So by the way, as of this year, there would actually be a track called Learning in Planning Track in the International Planning Competition to support this sort of stuff. And one thing I want to say is, in terms of thinking of learning techniques within planning, even if you're just only thinking of it for improving speed for the planners, and if you learned of machine learning before this only from applications such as web search or data mining, then there are some important differences. Okay, one thing, as I already told you, is most machine learning has, you know, in fact, the stuff that you see in many data mining courses, including even the statistical machine learning courses, completely ignores the background knowledge. It's as if you start fresh. All you know about the world is the data you see in front of you. It's a reasonable learning task. Sometimes that's a good learning task to work on. But there also sometimes you have partial knowledge about the world, and you want to be able to exploit it. Okay, there are classic cases. One I already told you, which is this my car example, right? I'll tell you one other example, which is quite a favorite of mine, which is you go into Sao Paulo airport in Brazil, and you get down and you get out of the customs. You see the first Brazilian guy, right? And this guy is wearing red shirt, green pants, he's wearing dark glasses, and he's speaking Portuguese. Just one example you have seen. What generalizations are you going to make? How many of you would make the generalization? So if I were to make the generalization that all Brazilians speak Portuguese, Okay, and he was to make the generalization, all Brazilians wear red shirts. I hope that you would laugh at him and not me. Right? And why? Why am I allowed to make this generalization, not that? Because we have higher level knowledge which says nationality tends to determine language. It's a functional dependency. Nationality tends to determine language. Nationality doesn't tend to determine as with as much certainty the color of the shirt one wears. Okay? So if you ignore that higher level knowledge, you would be very worried about making any kind of generalizations. Who knows? I mean, this one particular Brazilian speaks Portuguese and wears red shirt. And if you don't learn, the world is full of surprises for you. So you go to the second guy, he's also speaking Portuguese. Third guy, he's also speaking Portuguese. But you'd still be an exception. You would never really ready to make a jump. Okay? Domain knowledge provides you a bias. And you know, this background domain knowledge provides you a bias which allows you to make this generalization. And in the case of planning, you do have this background knowledge because you're starting from a domain model. Okay? So you get to think of learning techniques which are done in the presence of existing domain knowledge, which you have never done, even if you knew machine learning before. Okay. The other thing, of course, is much of the planning is sort of relational in structure. The domain model, you write action models in terms of predicates with their arguments. Okay. And much of the machine learning that you look at in the kind of a text mining kinds of scenarios or the data mining kind of scenarios is non-relational. It's propositional. Okay. And so, you know, you get to probably work more on the relational structure of, you know, learning problems with relational structure. Okay. And then the other thing, of course, is planning essentially involves sequential decisions. And so oftentimes there is this beautiful problem of credit blame assignment. Okay, so if you do this and do this and do this and do this and boom, you fail. Which of the actions are you going to blame? Okay, and you know, it turns out that learning in the context of sequential decision making is a much more interesting problem. In fact, the usual name associated with that is reinforcement learning. And you know, there is, you know, work in machine learning called reinforcement learning. We'll talk about it more in the context of planning here. But that's sort of the kind of things that you'll wind up learning about, which you would never touch in data mining courses. Okay. They're all machine learning. It's just what are you likely to look at. Okay. Okay, I assume that you know classification learning. I'm not going to give you much of a background on that. Now, the kinds of things that, you know, in terms of looking at learning from the context of planning, the kinds of dimensions that you want to look at, of course, are what is being learned, search control versus domain knowledge, what kind of background knowledge is used, nothing at all, full or partial background knowledge, online versus offline. That means, do you learn during planning and use the learned knowledge during planning and stop? Or do you learn beforehand and use this learned knowledge as part of the extra domain model? Okay? So online learning means you're learning during problem solving. Offline learning means there's a learning phase and there's a problem solving phase. Okay? Inter versus intra problem learning. This is sort of related, but not, it's kind of orthogonal too, in the sense, inter versus intra problem learning, you learn something for a problem and use it only in that problem. It's actually orthogonal. Whether it's offline or online, you may decide to take the initial state, goal state, and the domain model of the problem and learn whatever it is you want to learn for that problem and then use it only in solving that problem. Okay? Versus whatever learned knowledge you have will also get used for all other problems in the domain or maybe even across domains if you are particularly interested in it. Now, obviously, it's much easier to do intra-problem learning. When you try to do inter-problem learning, first of all, you need to generalize the learned knowledge. And if you're only using learned knowledge across problems within the same domain, the generalization level is less. If you want to use it across domains, it's much harder. So much so that, in fact, a big machine learning project that DARPA is pouring money into and is not going anywhere is transfer learning. And transfer learning essentially involves learning from one domain and using that learned knowledge in another domain. That's what we tend to do, right? I mean, yeah, but it's not all that easy. Okay. Then how is the training data for the planner obtained? And the training data for the planner can be obtained from self-exploration or exercise, especially if you're doing search control ruling. If you're doing learning search control rules, you could be talking about, you're looking at your own search and, you know, looking at the traces of the search and using that as, and deriving your training examples from that. Okay? Versus somebody gives you specific exercises. You work on these little planning problems first, learn whatever you can, and then I'll give you big problems later. Okay? And then obviously self-exploration, for example, one version of these is it from search tree? If you're doing search, you look at, you know, the branches and then use that as the background of the thing. Again, if you have read Sungwook's paper that I asked you to read, most of these should make sense to you in terms of what does he do in his paper. Okay, so for example, let's actually look at it. What's being learned in the context of Sungwook, the paper that you read? It's search control knowledge, because it's just improving the speed, not changing the domain model. What kind of background knowledge is used? Full, because you know the entire domain model. Okay? And did he actually use the domain model in picking the feature? So my question is the following. Based on all this stuff that I said earlier, would you say that Sungwook's paper actually uses explanation-based learning techniques or not? Or it just uses normal classification learning? He gets features. Some of the features are the current state, but there are some additional features that he also takes. They are from the relaxed plan. Now, what is the relaxed plan? Relaxed plan is an approximate explanation of why it's possible to go from this state to goal state. It's not a correct explanation. If you have the full plan, it will tell you how to go from this state to the goal state. Relaxed plan is an approximate explanation of why it is possible to go from this state to goal state. And he is using the features of the relaxed plan as features for learning. So he is doing relaxed plan analysis as a feature selection. Okay, and then doing classification on top of it. So you could actually think of what he's doing as EBL followed by induction. Okay, and then he's using it in the context of background knowledge. And is he doing it online or offline? He's doing it online because he's essentially during the problem solving, he's not doing it online. He's doing it offline because if he takes a benchmark domain, he solves the first 15 problems and takes all the failures in that to learn the delta function, and then the next whatever problems in the domain, he just solves them using this delta function. So RP plus delta is what he uses as a heuristic for the rest of them. So it's offline learning. Okay, and of course, in his comparisons, he sort of takes the time he spent in the online, the offline learning plus the time he spends in solving the problems. Okay, intra versus inter problem learning. Is he doing intra or inter problem learning? He's learning a delta, which is basically for any problem in that domain. So it is inter problem learning, but it's not inter domain learning. Okay. How is the training data obtained? Essentially by exercise. He's just taking first 15 problems, trying to solve them, using both the failing paths and succeeding paths to pick the training data out of it. Okay. And then how is his training data represented? How are his features represented? It's sort of interesting. I mean, for those of you, again, you know, I am playing this game of don't ask, don't tell, which is if I asked you guys whether or not you read this paper, I'm sure, did you read?
There's far more reading in this class than any other class.
That's why it's called a graduate class, right? And you have to do it. But the point is that either you read before or you go back and read after, okay? And in the end, either you get it or you don't get it, you know, and if you don't get it, come back and talk to me, okay? But not too much hand-holding is going to be done, okay? I'm happy to say that. But so If you didn't already read it, hopefully this discussion will make you read it in a directed fashion, which is okay with me. But just don't wait until the end of the semester, then everything will be new. Okay. So in his case, the thing that you want to look at in reading the paper, if you haven't already looked at it, is the taxonomic syntax, which is an interesting way of deriving features. They are not your Boolean yes or no feature. It's not attribute relation. A taxonomic feature essentially can have, which says, for example, how many blocks are clear in the current state? Okay, so it's sort of in between simple attribute representation and fully relational representation. And it winds up, you know, being quite useful for him. Okay? So, here is a, you know, what I'm trying to give you here is an overview of all the work that's been done in learning search control. Okay? And part of this is most of the work that's been done in learning search control for planning was done before 95 when planners were slow. And much of it hasn't shown its value now anymore, because those techniques don't seem to be easily applicable once the underlying planner became faster. Okay, so they were more of a crutch, but some of them are still working. Okay, so I won't look at many of them, but I'll give you an idea of, you know, a sort of a taxonomy of the ideas that have been tried. So to learn search control, you could either learn speed up learning, you could either do speed up learning, which is mostly what we will look at, which essentially tries to improve an existing planner. It takes a planner and tries to make it run faster. Okay? And the idea here is, basically you could learn rules to guide choice points of the kind that I talked about earlier. You can learn adjustments to heuristics, or you can learn plans to reuse. In learning plans to reuse, one aspect that is actually quite useful is this notion of macro operator. Okay, think of, you know, your domain comes with a single, bunch of actions. Okay, one thing that you can learn in terms of learning to reuse existing plans is, suppose you find that these 15 actions tend to come as a sequence in most plans you wind up using them. Okay? Then it's worth remembering this as a single macro action. Okay? So what it'll help you do is it'll start from the state before the first action, jump all the way to the state after the 15th action. It effectively reduces the solution depth by 15, actually by 14. Right? So what gives? Why isn't this a beautiful idea? I mean, if you remember the search complexity, it's b power d. And if you reduce d by like 14, that should be huge improvement. Right? Why, what's hard about then, you know, what are the trade-offs in using macro operator?
How do I know that the macro operator?
What? Well, in fact, that's not the hard part. It turns out that if I give you a whole bunch of plans, I mean, in fact, the plan itself sees a whole bunch of plans it generated, right? It can consider every possible sequence of operators as a macro. And because you have the full domain theory, you know exactly what is required before the sequence and what would be true after the sequence. You know this. So what is missing, of course, is how many of these sequences are you going to remember? That's the problem, because if you remember too many, then the B bloats up. So macro operators increase the branching factor, reduce the depth. And so it's not a free lunch. So you should be careful. You should avoid learning macro operators that won't be useful. And all the action in learning macros is completely about being very ruthless about throwing away macros that haven't proved their worth. Okay? It's almost sort of like learning macros is sort of like learning no goods in constraint satisfaction problems. Okay, the more no goods you learn, the less search you do. But if you have n variables, there are, you know, exponential number of no goods. And when you have exponential number of no goods, now you have increased your constraint exponentially. Okay, and so no good learning is not no good. It is actually quite good. But you have to be smart about how to remember no goods. And the state-of-the-art SAT solvers are very ruthless in removing no goods that, you know, they'll just keep a certain cache for the number of no goods that they're going to remember. And if it's full, they'll remove one of the bad guys. You know, macro operators, no goods, and paging strategies, caching, you know, bringing a page from secondary memory into RAM so that you can, if you wind up looking at that page again, you don't have to go back to the secondary memory. These are all caching strategies. Okay, you cannot prove that caching strategies will always be right. If the important thing is to make sure that, you know, you throw away things out of the cache, and the procedure you use to throw away things out of the cache winds up being important. Least recently used, most frequently used, the thing that when used makes the hugest amount of difference, all of these wind up being important. And it turns out that currently there is actually a planner called Marvin which does learn macro operators, and it actually does quite well in the competition domain. So it's not a laughable idea. Just like no goods can be very bad, you know, if you remember all the no goods, and yet it can be a very powerful idea if you know how to throw away. Okay. In fact, one of the big thing is forgetting is just as important a part of learning as learning, right? I mean, there are psychological studies showing that we forget a huge, huge, huge amount of stuff every day. Otherwise, you know, we won't get anything done. Okay, the important thing is not to forget anything I am saying, and then forget the rest. Then you'll be okay. But you know, forgetting is part of the deal. And you know, in the case of macros, you do forget. In the case of no good learning, you forget. Okay, yes, sir. If you have a complete domain model, yes. Because you see, the thing is. Okay, so let me actually show you an example. Not this. Okay, there. Here is an example. Okay, here is a problem that I just solved. In fact, not only can I learn, I can even learn in a generalized fashion. Okay, this is actually more than even a macro operator. Here I solved the following problem. You know, A and B and C and D are on the table. I put A on top of B and C on top of D. And the specific plan I did was to do put on AB first and then do put on CD. Okay? Now in fact, imagine the following thing. I can also give you another correct plan which involves put A on C, take A off C, put A on B, then put C on A, take C off A, put C on D. That is a correct plan. You would have this large plan in front of you right now. Okay? You can, if you want, you can go ahead and remember this entire plan as a good macro operator which takes you from this state to this state. Okay? However, the first thing you can do is you can convince yourself why is the plan correct to begin with. Explain the correctness of the plan. When you explain the correctness of the plan, you may be able to use that explanation to realize that some parts of the plan are actually not important. They can be removed. And so you can actually remember which piece of the plan is responsible for making which subsets of goals true. And so you have enough knowledge not only to check the correctness, but even to generalize. So in this particular case, I can try to prove the correctness of this plan using causal links. And the only constraints I need are the constraints required to make one proof go through. That's it. Something is correct if it is correct by one proof. Okay. Now it turns out that if I consider the causal links for supporting on AB, on CD, and also supporting these guys' preconditions, etc., then you will realize that this ordering is not actually needed. Nobody needs this ordering. If you remove this ordering, the proof will still go through, which means that ordering is not needed. So in fact, I can remember, in this case, a partially ordered macro operator, if I want. Okay, so this is more than what you needed, but it actually makes you realize that the macros you remember will be correct if you are remember learning macros in the context of full domain knowledge. Because that's what you're doing. You're doing this, the planner already has actions to make all the plans. You just wanted to do it faster. On the other hand, everything that I'm doing here is up for grabs in terms of correctness if you're trying to learn it without having a full domain model. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if you don't quite know why cars work, and you see that the mechanic, you know, whenever he does, like, you know, the following thing, he also seems to do these other three steps. So you somehow think all of them go together. Maybe they don't. Maybe he was doing it, you know, for completely different reasons than what why you thought it was being done. Okay, but in this case, you know, when you're learning macro operators exactly, you know, in the context of full domain theory, you can completely prove whether or not the macro is correct. It's not at all hard. Okay, and if I give you a sequence of operators, and I say here is the initial state, here is the goal state, here is a sequence of operators, convert this into a set of a single operator with preconditions and effects. It's not hard to do at all. Okay, you should do this at home. And, you know, and this idea of macro operators was used first with strips. And then it went away for a long time because people pointed out that B power D, B is increasing, D is reducing, that doesn't mean you can improve. And then it again came back now because people know that in those cases, you just have to be smart. You shouldn't keep all the macros around. You should throw away macros. And it's a question of keeping track of the utility of the macros and whether or not they're going to be useful. In general, this sort of learning that we are doing, you know, this sort of learning we are doing, all of this is called speed up learning. That is, you have the full domain model, you're trying to speed up the planner. And everything that you learned this way was actually deductively derivable from the underlying domain theory. Just as no goods are deductively derivable from the underlying CSP theory. Okay. However, and people actually sort of say that somehow speed up learning has this issue of utility. If you learn too many search control rules, you'll spend time matching them. Okay. And so even if they're not useful, if you have 10,000 search control rules saying, you know, check me whether or not I'm applicable, checking all of them to see whether they're applicable is useless effort. If none of them are applicable, you still wasted all your time. And you do it every time you expand a node. Okay? The same thing here. Macros will now be checked at every state for possible applicability, which increases the branching factor. Okay? Now, this learning adjustment heuristics doesn't have this problem, but these two have. Now, common misconception is to somehow say that speed up learning has this problem. That's not true. All learning has this problem. All learning has this problem. You can learn a lot of junk knowledge, and which sort of slows you down, and you have to be ruthless about removing some of it. Okay? It didn't really matter whether you learned the macros inductively or deductively. If you learn too many of them, it's going to slow down your speed. It didn't really matter whether you learned search control rules inductively or deductively. If you learn too many of them, it's slows down your speed. Okay? So as of now, I believe I explained to you to some extent the issue of what macro learning would look like. We discussed how the adjustments are done to heuristics. That paper actually gives more details. Okay? The one thing that I did not talk about much is learning choice points, and I'm going to show you a slide, but not go through it today Maybe we'll come back later, but it doesn't work nowadays anyway. So it's my work, but still it doesn't work anymore. So this was one of those. Pre-95, I was a big learning and planning guy. And I was very good when planners were bad. And now I no longer seem to be able to do this kind of work. And here, for example, what you do is you take the search tree and look at the failures at the search tree and do essentially something like a dependency-directed backtracking idea, and which will help you figure out in the search tree the reason this branch failed essentially is this rule. Okay, and that winds up, again, it's an explanation-based learning. You take one single example and you learn to predict why the failure occurred. One interesting thing is that explanations of failure normally are smaller than explanations of success. It's a weird thing, but oftentimes the reason you failed could be just one simple reason. You know, I failed, I died because, you know, I just crossed the road without looking at the traffic. The reason I succeeded is because I went to elementary school, I didn't sleep through the classes, I went to the grade school, I went to the middle school, never had any fun in life, that's why I succeeded. It's a much larger explanation, okay? So success explanations tend to be larger, and they wind up touching on many more features than the failure explanations. And the smaller the explanation, the stronger the feature selection, because you're essentially selecting the features that are relevant to explaining the label. In the context of full domain theory, in fact, you can use a single example to learn rules like this. Yes?
Why is this not good at all?
Because of this. It turns out that many a time, what happens is, many a time, it's one nice thing that happened in the search tree is for every failure, there is an explanation. Okay? This would work if you're doing depth-first search, and if it's a finite depth tree, and ultimately every branch has to either fail or succeed. And so it works completely in CSP. In planning, on the other hand, even if you do depth-first, you can be going into la-la land. You can be doing looping. In this case, it's a plan space planner, partial order planner. Okay, so at some point of time, you ignore a branch, not because you know why it failed, but because you say it's crossed the depth limit. That explanation is not a good explanation. Why? Because if you cross the depth limit, what's wrong with you? Everything about you is wrong. Do you understand what I'm saying? When a node fails, this node has a huge number of things. It has all these goals, all these steps, all these causal links. And yet, the reason it failed is this one simple ordering cycle. That's it. Okay? And if I have such an analytical failure, then that helps me figure out why this branch failed in a nice way. Okay? If all I can say is, well, this plan is just a bad plan. I don't like this plan because it crossed the depth limit. Then what happens is the explanation for the failure of the plan is now just as big as explanation for its success. The entire plan is the reason why it failed. In such a case, when you regress up, essentially you won't learn any useful knowledge. It's a very subtle point, but if anybody ever tells you, you know, you screw up, let's say you give a bad talk or you write a bad paper, and if anybody ever tells you and you ask them, what can I do to improve this, and they say, well, it's just you, right? There's nothing you can learn from that. Nothing. Okay? I have to say something more specific. It's bad because, you know, you did not use capitalization in the beginning of the sentence.
It's hard to figure out which part you learned is useful, which part is
useful. I know, but the big issue winds up being that you would, many a time, A, you don't use depth first search in planning, and B, unless, you know, sometimes the nodes that cross the depth limit, you may wind up actually having to find real reasons why they failed, even if the planner didn't see it. Okay, you know, I would love to see it work. So if you have a way of making it work, you know, use pass the course. But in general, that's the full domain theory with failure-based explanation rules isn't working as of today. But I got all my papers out of it, so you know, I'm fine. Okay, so we'll stop here. And next class, we really, really will do oversubscription planning. And sometime later, we'll again come back to learning and planning, but for domain models.